Welcome back to this Memorial Day edition of Catholic Answers Live. How are you getting to enjoy Memorial Day a little bit? Got all the white clothes out of the closet and
your tennis togs.
Tennis togs? Is that what you said? It is time for summer here in America, but Memorial Day has a very a solemn meaning here. This is the day that we remember those who have given their lives in the military service of this country, in the defense of this country. And this society over the centuries founded after the Civil War, and
Memorial Day. Not the country was not founded after the Civil War.
No, the Memorial. Excuse Day. Me, the Memorial was founded.
Thank you very much.
After the Civil War, well, it was a what was Lincoln's a refounding or a?
Yes, we don't need to go.
We don't. We don't talk about what Lincoln.
Chris
said
isn't
about
here,
that.
So it's okay.
Okay, so we do indeed today remember those who have died for the love of this country. But a country is not just a set of ideas, or as it's sometimes called, an experiment. It's a place and a people, and this place and this people. Have roots that go much farther back than most of us know, or in some cases will admit. So this Memorial Day, we're going to take the opportunity to also remember the founders, not just of our nation, but of our world, a world of families and homes, of many, I suppose I could say, homey goods that find their earliest beginnings in a place we call Catholic England. And in addition to being a Memorial Day, the liturgical calendar gives us the fortuitous coincidence, I suppose, that it is also the feast day of the founder of Catholic England. I think that's the way to say it, Augustine of Canterbury.
In large part, you're at St. Augustine of Canterbury, right.
Yep. Exactly. Here to help us do that is if he could, he'd be an Englishman.
I am an Englishman.
Oh, you are an Englishman. Okay.
In blood, I am, yes.
Okay.
My ancestors came here from England, from nowhere else, so
that's our chaplain, Father Hugh Barber, also a Norbertine priest and former prior of St. Michael's Abbey. And Father, so you are an English. Well, you have your father was an Anglican priest.
Right, exactly. But
okay. So England is the father of America in its... not just in its ideas, but in its personality.
Better to say the mother of America.
The mother. Okay,
countries are women, right? They're female.
Man. America is our habits, our establishing habits, not just our ideas, but our English habits. Isn't that correct?
Well, it's not very popular to say that nowadays, of course, in the madness of the current political and ideological cycle. Where everything that is English or European or original is regarded as somehow oppressive and to be overcome.
But
it's simply true that our system of government, our economy, our fundamental culture, and our religion all come from the British Isles.
Right.
For sure.
Yep.
And what's intriguing in that regard is we live in a country where, you know, a large number of people that are politically engaged, they're from the more evangelical or Protestant tradition. And so sometimes you get the impression that they never consider, well, where did my Christianity come from? Where did it come from? And because you just have the idea that somehow they have a view of history where, you know, it was Adam and Eve and then Abraham and then Moses and then Jesus and then 1776.
Yeah, right,
and
exactly.
The great city on the hill, and then finally, the American interest in world, improving the world. That's kind of the whole, you know, the way that we view it.
Right.
But we forget, and what Protestants often don't realize, even megachurch Protestants and all that, is that they're Christians from their family tradition or their background.
Yes.
Because certain persons came to England, to Britain, to the British Isles, to bring the Catholic faith to them, and they received it and accepted it. And even those who then veered into Protestantism, still the only reason they're Christians, the only reason they wanted to reform the church that had been founded there in England was because it had been founded there.
Right.
And so all of us, English-speaking Christians, and then by extension, all the English-speaking Christians who are in Nigeria.
Right.
India.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
All over the world. Yeah. Singapore, you mm-hmm. name it. They're all Christians because a certain group of people came to England at a certain point of time
yeah.
and evangelized the people and established the church there and finally church order.
So that's why we want to dedicate some time to talking about this particular man, Augustine of Canterbury. But there's also another group, if I may, before we move on and get your comment on this, there's another group that has a kind of ingratitude to this Catholic Europe and a kind of amnesic ingratitude. And that's the kind of globalist European Union types who completely forget that their civilization was founded by people who lived their life under the crucifix.
No, it's quite remarkable that when the EU was putting its constitution out, the Holy See and several other right-thinking people in Europe tried to get some mention
yeah.
in the historical part of the influence of Christianity over right. the establishment of Europe.
Can you imagine that?
And they couldn't. They went from Greek and Roman antiquity to the French Revolution. And so they skipped because, you know, as Hilary Belloc said, you know, there's a great book of his, Europe and the Faith. Europe is the faith and the faith Europe. That is, Europe doesn't exist. The European identity
right.
doesn't exist without Catholicism or Orthodoxy, which is kind of more or less a form of Catholicism.
Right.
And so,
but liturgical Christianity,
right.
Certainly.
Liturgical Christianity, to be yeah. sure. Yeah. Absolutely. And so, what can you do? They deliberately skip that because the question is what made all this cohere after the waning, I won't say the fall, but the waning of the Roman imperial system, if it wasn't the Christian faith, it was brought by such persons as St. Augustine of Canterbury, whose feast we celebrate today, who brought the faith to England in difficult circumstances and planted it there, even though it was there a little bit before, but that's, we'll talk about that later.
Yeah, okay. So maybe we can get an image of, just a picture of the world then. Augustine is a man of the 500s, basically.
Right. He
He died early 600s. Yes. 607.
On May 26th, but the feast day is on May 27th. So that's why we're talking about him today.
You get as close as you can.
Right.
That's
exactly.
how we do it in the Catholic yeah. Church. You get as close as you can. His world, like we think now of Christianity, I really think modern people think of Christianity as some kind of European thing. And in his world, it would have been much more extensive than that. They would not have thought of it. I mean, certainly North Africa was still Christian.
Well, North Africa was ripe. It was going to be, Christianity was going to be wiped out there very quickly. But at the point
still had,
when he was, they still had Christians in North Africa.
Right.
But no, they had the more Roman notion of the Orbis Terrarum, that is just the circle of countries that surround the central ocean, the Mediterranean.
Right.
And everything else was off in a corner somewhere. And so they went to evangelize out from the center, which was the Mediterranean. And gradually they evangelized farther and farther and farther to the north, to the east, to the west, and Christianize all those populations. So you have in the east, you've got the Slavs and the
yeah.
Latvians and Estonians and all those people. And then you've got all the different Slavic peoples. And then you have in the west, you've got all the Celts.
Yeah, right.
Lots of Celts, both in northern France and then, of course, in England and Ireland.
Mm-hmm. So you won't say it. I wouldn't make you say it, but I'll probably say it. I don't know if this is too harsh a way to say it. The reason that today we think of that Christianity is growing in Europe and not in Africa is that North Africa was assaulted by an invasion, a religious invasion, where people were put to the sword if they did not convert to Islam.
Right.
That's a historical fact.
Yeah, that was
it's very controversial to say it, but that's what broke Christendom off from
course,
Africa.
Right. And although they had an initial persecution because the Arian Christians were heretics, they had a persecution, but then the faith was restored under the Byzantine emperors, and then finally with the Islamic invasions, yeah. it was wiped out completely. That's the same process that led through North Africa to Spain.
Yeah,
and the establishment of the caliphates in Spain,
but
in Spain though they didn't succeed in suppressing the faith among the population. It was too deeply Christianized, not just at the coasts but inland, and so they were they were confronted with a, you know, a large inland
Catholic
population, so they were not able to do that.
So the world that, that Bede then is in, which is which comes a century or two before these event, the Muslim conquests across a half of Christianity, really. Yeah. The world that Bede is in is centered around the Mediterranean. So when he gets sent to
England, Augustine.
Excuse me. Who did I say? What?
Augustine. You said Bede, but it's Augustine.
Oh, Bede. No, yeah. When
Bede writes about him, but later.
Yeah. Okay. So with that, where Augustine gets sent, this is not a plum assignment, getting sent to England at the time.
No, not at all. See, what happens is that you have the whole Roman Empire, which extends all the way from Hadrian's Wall, mm-hmm. you know, right at the edge of Scotland, all the way down to Upper Egypt, and yeah. all the way over to almost to through into Persia, and so it's an enormous place. So this Roman Empire gradually, in the 5th century particularly, it began to sort of contract. It was contracting a little bit before. And in 410, the Roman legions left England. They left the island. Now, there were already Christians there because, of course, in the Roman period, there were lots of Christians in the Roman army and in other positions. And so the faith had already been brought to England by Christians at that time, and they were practicing the faith and so on. But with the withdrawal of the Roman legions, then the connection between the continent and England was broken.
Yeah.
And so you had an English church or a small group of Christians, smaller and smaller as it turned out, that was not in regular contact with the See of Rome or the Episcopate in France or other places, the Orthodox Episcopate in France and other places, the ones that actually accepted the faith in Nicaea and all of that. And so they ran into that difficulty, and so the faith waned. Of course, they had these invasions by the Saxons, who were pagans.
Yep.
And so you ended up, by the time of St. Augustine, or St. Gregory the Great, who sent him to England in the late 6th century, of they're just the Christians are all the Britons on the west coast of England, and they're Celts, by the way.
Yeah.
Just to make everyone happy. They were not Anglo-Saxons, they were Celts.
No, they lost to the Anglo-Saxons.
Right,
really.
they did, but they were the Christians.
Yep.
And then there were little pockets here and there. And Pope Gregory the great pope of the 6th century, the great pope that practically founded medieval Christianity in so many ways, so much you could say about him. The legend goes, according to Bede the Venerable, that he was in the Roman market there, and they were selling slaves because, surprise, surprise, the Roman system survived on slaves. And he saw these beautiful blonde slaves who were being sold, and he asked, "What were they?" And they said they're angels. And he said, "Not angels, but angels shall they be." And that was the famous line.
Right.
And then subsequently, he sends the prior of the monastery of which he was a member originally, of St. Andrew's on the Celian Hill. Which is still, I mean, the place is still there. You can see it. He sent him with a group of about 40 monks and other people to go up and establish a mission in England. The King of Kent had, who was a pagan, Ethelbert, but was married to a Frankish Catholic wife.
Mm-hmm.
And the Franks are very important in the history of Christian Europe because the Franks were the one Germanic tribe that didn't succumb to Arianism. They didn't join the heretical form of Christianity, and so wherever they went, they established Nicene Orthodoxy, that is, the faith in the full divinity of the Savior and the Blessed Trinity, and so
faith on. Faith like as we know it now,
right? As we know it, and she had great influence over him, and he was perfectly happy to have missionaries come and evangelize his people and you know make them you know happier and better and so on, so. There were communications between Gregory and King Ethelbert, and so the mission was sent with letters and you know all the usual things because they have to go all the way through Gaul, visiting bishops and monasteries throughout you know, as they go along.
So it's a lot of diplomacy even just to get these missionaries to England,
right? Because they have to deal with the local rulers. They couldn't just come in, you know, without representation.
Father, I have to take a break.
Okay.
So when we come back, we'll talk more about how Augustine and his merry band got to England and how England became Catholic when we come back on Catholic Answers Live.
Stay with us for more Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live is brought to you in part by CatholicSingles.com, the website for Catholics who want to meet others who share their faith and values for faith, fellowship, and love. You can learn more at CatholicSingles.com. Catholic Answers Live thanks CatholicSingles.com for their generous support.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Why do we need to pray? Well, the Catholic faith is all about communion with God. And prayer is the form that our communion with God takes. If we're not praying, we're not in communion with God. But we can get in communion with God really quickly by prayer. It's the easiest, quickest, and only route to connect to our Creator. And that's what we're made for. That's why we need to pray.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, Memorial Day edition. Today we remember all those who gave their lives in the military service of this country. And that is a great good to have defended the homeland, defended family, and at the cost of one's life. And military service, if I am correct, and I'm asking you because you're the Aquinas man here. Doesn't he put it under the virtue of charity? Doesn't he say it's charitable to?
Well, to be sure, but I mean, all the Christian virtues are informed by charity. But
oh, okay.
But in particular, where one is, it's the pietas, the form of charity, which is related piety, which is related to the one's sense of recognition for the good that has been done one by one's family and nation.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Okay. But for there to be something to defend, somebody had to build it. And part of the building of America and a great deal of the world, we can find its roots in the evangelizing efforts of extraordinary people like Gregory the Great and Augustine of Canterbury, who we are discussing today. Today is the feast day of St. Augustine of Canterbury. So in the late 500s or mid to late 500s.
Yeah, 595, around in there.
Yeah. Oh, so really late 500s, yep. Yeah. Gregory the Great meets some people in Rome who are being sold as slaves from England.
That's how the story goes. But obviously there was a lot more going on than just that.
Right, but because Gregory, Gregory the Great, he wanted to go himself. He would have gone to England, but they made him Pope, I think.
Right, he was Pope, right. And he was in a happy in a Benedictine monastery.
Yeah. But so this is what I wanted to get to because this is where we left it. So here's this guy, a fellow monk of this monastery. He sends him. He must think very highly of him, sends him on this important mission to England. There's a connection between monasticism and evangelization here that maybe is an important connection that we don't often make. We think of the missionary as one kind of person and the monastic as a different kind of person.
Well, that notion is very modern in the sense of it's after the French Revolution when the stable monasteries were so devastated and they founded a lot of new congregations that were devoted to active works, missionary work, and so on. So we're used to that idea. But for the establishment of Christian Europe, the evangelization of all of Europe, all of it,
yeah,
practically, both East and West, both Byzantine and Latin,
yeah,
was due to the establishment of monasteries in the countryside. Because in the Roman world, the dioceses were set up in cities. And the original patristic church, say in the 4th century, it was an urban reality. You had a bishop of a particular city. We still have that now. We have a diocese and there's always a see city.
Right.
But the countryside went largely neglected. That is, if you were in the city,
you could get
lots of access to the sacraments and instruction and everything else. In the countryside, there wasn't very much. But monasteries tended to seek places that were not in the city itself. I mean, there are city monasteries, but mostly they sought a more secluded or rural context in which they survived also by farming and so on. And so this was the natural instrument whereby the country folk, the heathen means dwellers on the heath, the country folks, the pagans, pagan means someone who lives in the countryside.
Yeah.
And that's in our language, we already have it there, that they're the last ones to convert.
Right.
Because they're there, you know, not without the sophistication of all the teaching that you find in the city. And so the monasteries, in being founded, they become the natural centers of the evangelization of the country folk.
Right.
And then naturally, since they see the need and they found new monasteries, affiliations of different new monasteries, one monastery founds another.
Yeah.
So they gradually expand and evangelize a whole territory
right.
by the foundation of monasteries. So we shouldn't imagine that in the early Middle Ages that the monks were just going around with drawn cheeks chanting and not paying attention to anybody.
It's a real act of service.
No, they're actually evangelizing people from the ground up.
And they're evangelizing people by doing things like taking care of sick people who come to the monastery.
Well, the sick and the pilgrims and so on, but the pilgrims come a little bit later. But they actually did it mostly by chopping down idols and showing that their gods were not going to punish them when they did it.
Who's that did that?
St. Boniface, yeah.
St. Boniface, that's right, actually, cut down the tree.
There are any
tree.
Number of medieval missionaries who just said, look, you know, let's see if your gods will do anything to me if I get rid of this.
Right, and, you know, right. You know. So really this kind of missionary activity then, we should think of it in a kind of holistic way that they're bringing Christ. But it's not just a preaching of Christ. It's like a mentoring in Christ by being a community of Christians in the midst of these other people.
Right. And that's the beautiful reality of the early evangelization of Europe, both East and West, by the monastics, because Christianity was always conveyed in those days in the context of Christians who lived a community life and gave it to others.
Yeah,
In the modern period, we've had lots of missionary work, and it's been very effective. But it was more in the context of colonialization.
Yes.
And that the facility with which if you have great world powers that have colonies, well, then, of course, they like the church to come along and set up schools and hospitals and other good social works and so on and so forth. And so they'll tolerate the, you know, sort of Masonic people that run England and the States and whatnot. They'll tolerate these religious people and converting them because they think, well, it makes them better citizens, so it's all okay.
Yeah.
But the cultural impulse is a little more practical and political.
Right.
Right. And so the Christian community aspect has to be developed later. And that's what we see very deeply in places like Nigeria and India and other parts of Asia that on their own, independently of the missionaries, they find the Christian identity and the Christian community life that didn't come from their colonial overlords, but rather, you know, because they accepted the faith and persevered in it.
Do you think that this stability of these monk missionaries who go out onto the heath and build a new thing, that their stability in life also contributes to a kind of evangelization of the family, in that the family becomes more stable and an institution to kind of foster faith together? Does that happen?
It was one of the more delicate aspects of the evangelization. We see that also in Africa now, in particular, that is the Christianization or sacramentalization of the notion of marriage and family.
Mm-hmm.
And it's you know, because you have these large clans and tribes, and their identity is primarily and fundamentally their family identity.
Mm-hmm.
And to insert the revealed religious sacramental identity into that context is a thing that takes a long, long time, you know.
I see, yeah.
Before it actually sinks in.
Right.
And so the customs surrounding marriage and family life, they develop little by little under the influence of the gospel, but with great difficulty. But it still is a reality. That's why we're sometimes shocked by the marriage practices of, you know, early medieval Europe. But you have to realize that it's an entire culture that's being Christianized. Just as in modern Africa, it's the same way, that the polygamy, for example, is not something people abandon very swiftly, even if they're interested in Christianity. So you have to be working on it. So that notion of Christian marriage, which finally triumphed in Europe for a pretty good long period of time, was really an accomplishment that took centuries.
But what strikes me about that, we'll have to probably talk about this after the break, but this idea of monk missionaries that we're going to establish something and it's communal, and it has a kind of lasting power. It has the power to slowly do that, to make those. It's not just I'm coming here to visit you on a mission trip. It's that we're putting down roots here, and those roots are I'm going to spend the rest of my life here. And not only that, the next guy is going to spend the rest of his life. And if it takes 1,000 years, we're here to develop Christian society.
And that's where you see in Europe. If you look in Central Europe, you go to a country like Hungary, the monastery of Pannonhalma was founded by St. Stephen, and it was, it's over 1,000 years old, more than 1,000 years old, and it's still a center of education and faith.
We're talking about the roots, really, of how did we end up with this society that we enjoy and in some ways are trying to tear down, I suppose, now. But we'll get to the person, the man himself, Augustine of Canterbury, when we come back with Father Hugh Barber on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live.
In his new audio presentation, The Very First Fathers, apologist Jimmy Akin takes you on a tour of the earliest Christian writings outside the New Testament. From the most famous figures and most notable works to those lesser known but no less important, this pivotal time in the development of the early church is revealed in fascinating detail. Jimmy shows how, even in the first century after the resurrection, it was necessary to defend and explain truths that are still under attack today, such as the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist and the perpetual virginity of Mary. The Very First Fathers is a compelling look at the dawn of the Christian age and edifying listening for anyone who wants to understand and defend the full truth of Catholicism. Order your copy of The Very First Fathers today by calling 1-888-291-8000, logging on to the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
Love and beauty. As a little girl, Dawn Eden Goldstein knew that she wanted those things, that in them somehow she would find God. Over the years as a rock journalist, she moved among some of popular music's best-known artists, straining to capture that transcendent love and beauty in every note and lyric. In Sunday Will Never Be the Same, Dawn recounts her spiritual journey in beautifully wrought detail, mixing powerful accounts of trauma, healing, and epiphany with funny anecdotes from inside the music scene. It is the rare conversion story that delights as it inspires, amuses as it edifies, and ultimately lays before the reader a lived testimony to the transforming grace of Christ. Order your copy of Sunday Will Never Be the Same by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Welcome back and happy Memorial Day from all of us here at Catholic Answers. And it's also the feast day of St. Augustine of Canterbury. So we're talking a bit about the roots of this society that so many have died defending, and those roots go all the way back to missionaries sent from Italy to, or what we now think of as Italy, what we now think of as England. Mm-hmm. And so maybe we could dig in a little bit. Our guest, by the way, is Father Hugh Barber, our chaplain and a Norbertine priest. And you got any Norbertines in England? I never even thought to ask you.
Oh, yeah, they're Norbertines, yeah.
But that's not where you're founded. Central Europe.
We were founded in northeastern France.
Okay.
By a German, but that's in those days it didn't much matter. But no, the order was in England from the beginning. We had 35 abbeys at the time of the dissolution.
Okay, so all right, now I'm going to change direction from what I was going to ask you. We'll get back to it. But okay, so we were talking in the last segment about how the conversion of England is in many ways a monastic phenomenon. Monastery, building another mm-hmm. monastery, 20 miles down the road or mm-hmm. 100 miles away or whatever. And this settles the country, and it provides people access to the sacraments and to education and to healthcare and all
farming those— Farming and all that.
All that stuff, right? Farming improvement, all that. So— now, after 1,000 years of building monasteries and serving England in this way and building the culture of England, the Catholic Church just has monasteries all over England, right? We just have—
Everywhere.
So What's the condition of the Catholic monasteries in England now? All those, what happened to them, Father?
Well, certain greedy people using, well, it is true.
I know, I like it.
Using the pretext of the church reform.
Yeah.
Because of course, you know, the clergy are imperfect and if you look for a scandal, you're going to find one.
Oh, yes.
And you can find plenty if you keep looking. And so consequently, different people convinced Henry VIII to Cromwell and these other people to do inventories of the monasteries with a view to confiscating their property and suppressing them. And so that's what happened. And so they suppressed the monasteries. It's almost as though the conversion of England is this long process of monasticization of the countryside.
Right.
And then the separation of England from the great body of European Christianity began with the suppression of the monasteries. Just as in France with the Revolution, the first law they pass is the suppression of religious vows. The first law.
Right.
And then the second one was no-fault divorce.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's just very clear. They saw very clearly what they were trying to do. And so, no, so the monastery, and so that's why, you know, you have Downton Abbey.
Which is called Downton Abbey.
Downton Abbey, because all these old country estates that belonged to the nobility, they were once abbeys, you know, and right. So they still are called abbeys.
Yeah.
But the land was given by the crown to various useful political allies.
Yeah. So I guess the reason I want to get to that in part is to connect to today. We do experience, and England has certainly experienced this. America is now experiencing it, maybe coming late to the party, aggressive de-Christianization. And so for those of us who are Christian, we may want to make a political response or even a cultural response of this or that kind, but we can learn from these people who built the monasteries about what it takes to actually convert or reconvert a culture.
Well, you have to live with people and share the faith with them in a concrete context. But for the world to destroy the church, all that's needed is greed.
Yeah.
And that's what we see today. It's where we see, you know, these people that go after the church today, they're not interested in church reform. They're interested in lawsuits
and money.
Yeah. Lots of money.
Right.
And that doesn't justify any evil thing that any evil cleric ever did.
No.
But the fact is, the motivations are not exactly pure. If they were, they would be going around saving people all over the place from various kinds of immorality. But they don't do that. They focus on the Catholic Church.
Right.
And so that gives you a kind of a picture. Our Lord said that anyone who gives up mother, father, brother, sister, lands for my sake and for the gospel will receive in this world 100 times more brothers, sisters, others, and properties with persecution in the world to come, life everlasting. So the Lord predicts this. When people give up everything to follow him, which is what the monks do, they will grow rich.
Right, yeah. Right.
They will grow rich because yeah. They're not owning property themselves, and they run these big farms, and then they have all these people working for them and with them, and it lasts for centuries. And of course, it becomes a very substantial reality. And then
right. The
envy of the world, where people that don't believe in pure motivations and don't believe in right. Our religion, they will go after whatever it is we possess because right. They figure that we must be like them.
Yeah,
you know, that all we do it all for the money.
Yeah.
Like people like, you know, Mr. Avenatti, for example, you know, that they just think that that's what everyone does, you know.
Right.
They're just always out for the money.
But you can't, it's very hard for the modern person to imagine that 1,000 years ago, some monks built a monastery there in the middle of a swamp, and then they spent 100 years filling in that swamp
with
and making
rocks.
It arable land so that it could be farmland.
That's our Mother Abbey of Premontre. It was
yeah.
kind of a marsh.
And then when the revolution, when the French Revolution comes, well, look at all the wealth they have. Let's just take that away from
take
them.
Take it away from them,
but
yeah.
they literally physically built Europe, not just
right. Spiritually,
right. but physically
and economically.
Yeah.
And economically, I mean, our founding fathers of our abbey, which came from Hungary, they still had the properties they had in the Middle Ages. So in 1945, they had like 20,000 hectares, which meant all these villages and all these farmers who had worked in these villages for centuries. And these are prosperous farmers.
Yeah.
And, you know, but it all belongs to the abbey, but, you know, no, everybody is very well off. That's why the communists went after these people. They hated the the farmers that farmed land that belonged to noblemen or monasteries more than anybody else.
Because the farmers were doing well.
Because they were part of the system they wanted to destroy.
Yeah.
And so then they confiscate the land and then they redistribute it. And what does that mean? They give it to other people, but they don't let them farm it the way they want to. They have to farm it according to the government's 3-year plan or 5-year plan or 10-year plan. I mean, it's just
the Ukrainians how that works.
Yeah, exactly. So in any case, yes, the church's possession of material wealth leads to the envy of her enemies.
Right, but that material wealth is built up over centuries, and it's built up because a society is built up that can maintain and care for that.
Because people of their generosity gave,
right,
and they gave their properties.
And you think of a place like Notre Dame burning because people didn't take care of it in the modern context. They were trying to do a little something, but you think of that, the loss of, I mean, we thought we were losing the whole church when it was burning.
No.
But the reason those things are there and are maintained for 1,000 years is because this is a community of faith that does those things willingly.
And because in the beginning, some nobleman and his wife in their later marriage decided to enter religion, and he became a lay brother, because they never became priests, these married ones, and then the wife became a sister,
yeah,
and they donated their entire estate to found a monastery.
Right.
And then they live simply like poor religious, everybody else.
And this process
That's
really—
That's not something American corporate moguls do.
No, right. We have a different sense of what property is, about what money's for and all that.
Yeah.
So at the very beginning of that process in England is this man, Augustine of Canterbury. Who is he?
So St. Gregory the great pope who really determined the trajectory of the church's history in the Middle Ages in so many ways. We could go on and on about that. But he had very much at heart the reestablishment of church order in England, because they're quite conscious that, you know, for over 100 years, 150 years or so, there hadn't been any regular contact, even mm-hmm. though there was obviously a well-established Christian church there. And then when he saw the paganized Angles, who were, of course, well, not paganized, they were pagans, there in the market, he was touched also with the desire to accomplish their conversion. So he takes the prior of the monastery of St. Andrew on the Sealing Hill in Rome, which is his monastery also originally before he was made pope, commissions him to bring a whole body of monks and other people to England at the invitation of the King of Kent, which is down in the southeastern part of England, to evangelize the people there. And so, because there wasn't much evidence when the Romans left, the Celtic Christians, the Britons, they didn't try to evangelize the pagan tribes that invaded. They just tried to protect themselves from it, and they didn't.
Yeah.
So the eastern part of England was mostly pagan.
Okay.
And the western coast, the Britons were all like, you know, Wales and Cornwall and all that. They were all, you know, still Christians. So the Pope sent him up there with an équipe of monks and others, and with letters for all the bishops coming and whatnot. They were daunted, though. It seemed to them, as people kept telling them more as they were traveling, they'd stop and visit people and they'd tell them what it's like there in England and whatnot. And, of course, the Pope had not imagined that the practices and church order of the English church had veered so far from the Roman norms,
right,
at the time. And so they became a little bit worried that it was going to be a lot harder sell.
Yeah.
Not so much to the pagans, whom they were going to convert very successfully, but getting along with the Christians that were still there,
yeah,
who were used to functioning without any outside authority.
It sounds like the Japanese after the But maybe without quite the fidelity that the Japanese held after the Jesuits.
Well,
were,
I mean,
thrown.
No, but there were whole regions of England. It was the yeah, coast, so these were kingdoms.
Yeah, and they were Christian, but they were Christian that had
there were Catholic
were
Christians
alienated
that had been,
from the
Catholic Christians who had been separated from regular commerce with the
for more than
the
a
continental
century.
Church and the Roman Church.
Yeah,
so they had many differences in practice and church order, and were very much attached to those practices. They had the more or less the Yeah, it's early Celtic church. So, but Gregory, of course, is completely taking for granted that as the Bishop of Rome, he can send people, and then the bishops or the clergy who are already there would just naturally and automatically offer their obedience and,
right.
and acceptance. But this was something which was very hard to accomplish because they were used to functioning on their own. So St. Augustine comes there, but they were hearing about it, and finally they were so daunted that they asked permission from the Pope to come back, just to turn around and go back. That's why they, when that one guy saying that Gregory was not that, or Augustine was not that
courageous.
No, they were daunted by it. They thought, oh no,
like, you know,
what are we getting into?
What are we getting into?
But then Pope Gregory said, no, you have to go. No.
Yeah.
So they obeyed and went. And of course, they had a warm greeting from the king of Kent, who later becomes a Christian, and his wife. He's Ethelbert. She's Bertha, and she's a Frankish princess. Now, the Franks were great at spreading Roman Catholicism all over because they were Roman Christians. They always were known for their obedience or their interest in Rome. That's why when they said that France is the first daughter of the church, eldest daughter of the church,
right.
Well, it's the Franks, you know, who are a Germanic tribe, but later on they become the French, you know.
Yeah.
But that influence there of his wife. And so he was given the use of a church, Church St. Martin in Canterbury. Canterbury was the royal see of Kent. And so they set up the church there and the monastery, and brought the rule of St. Benedict, although some people say they didn't, but I mean, come on, there was a Benedictine monastery in Italy, so
yeah.
Obviously it's going to be a Benedictine monastery in England. And in fact, probably the first Benedictine abbey outside of Italy ever.
Oh, really? There, because yeah. And when you think of it, even the Benedictine movement, it's pretty new at that point.
Yeah.
Like very old.
No, it's not. It's the same epoch, practically, just a generation or two before. And so they set up the Benedictine life there. They set up the monastery of St. Peter and Paul, which is, of course, the Cathedral of Canterbury. And they begin the evangelization of the people. And the king is perfectly happy with that. And in a letter to the Patriarch of Alexandria, St. Augustine of Canterbury boasts that on Christmas Day of X year, they baptized 10,000 people. That's what they said, 10,000. It's possible. They were organized back then. It's similar to what you would consider the things that you hear, and that's why sometimes historians poo-poo these numbers and whatnot, but when you look at the evangelization of Mexico, for example, and the Franciscans, they baptized 10,000 people at a time.
Do you think part of that is that people had a more sense of I'm a part of this community. Oh, if we're becoming Christian, we all become Christian together.
Right, right. It's an extension of the idea that, you know, the child who's baptized before the age of reason accepts, in a certain sense, implicitly the judgment of his parents.
Right.
And so simple people that follow their leaders, they accept Christianity. The point about Christianity is you have to accept it freely, but it doesn't mean that you have to understand everything you're being taught, because that comes later. And so they evangelized very successfully the region there, and then Augustine set up two new dioceses. He was in Canterbury, which became the primatial see of England. It's the primatial see, meaning the head bishop in any region or province of the church. So the primate of England is Canterbury, and then he sets up. There's another primate, York, but that's another story. Then he sets up two new dioceses: first London and Rochester. Those are the first two dioceses other than Canterbury in England, and commences the evangelization of the Anglo-Saxons, which of course is an event which has a tremendous impact on world history, as we well understand. All those missionaries all the way into the 19th century and beyond owe their Christianity to this original conversion, whether they were Protestants or not. I mean, they're Protestant Christians. They wouldn't have been Christians at all if it weren't for the Catholics. So, you know, we all owe this, you know, in that world to them.
Yeah.
And, so it's
so I want to talk about that, about the consequences of what Augustine and people like Augustine, his companions and all that did, certainly reverberate all throughout history. Is it fair to say, if I can just kind of get a yes or no from you before we have to take this break, and then we'll come back and explain it, that the English, for some reason, England plays a special role. It has a kind of pivotal role in Christian history. Is that a fair thing to say?
I would say Christian history, yes, but history generally, yeah, because a lot of what England did as a pivotal thing came after religion was the principal motivation. But in any case, yes.
Okay. All right. All right. We'll take a quick break. We'll be right back with more of our Memorial Day reflections on the roots of our own society in the ancient English society right after this with Father Hugh Barber.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at Catholic.com.
St. John Paul II stated that, for the disciple of Christ, evangelization is a duty, an obligation of love. And the Catechism of the Catholic Church states that evangelization is necessary for salvation.
So we know we're called, but how do we do it?
St. Paul Street Evangelization can help. To learn more, contact us at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Vatican officials will meet to decide the fate of disgraced former Cardinal Theodore McCarrick.
Pro-life leaders applauding the president's strong stand for life.
A new poll finds most Americans, including those identifying as pro-choice, are opposed to late-term abortion.
And Pope Francis says the death penalty is contrary to the gospel.
News headlines you can have faith in. Weekdays at the top of the hour on EWTN Radio.
I like America. I'm grateful to America as my mother, as my home. And on this Memorial Day, how'd she get to be the way she is? Well, we're looking back all the way to Augustine of Canterbury, which by good fortune, it is his feast day as well. He's one of the named and remembered among the thousands and thousands and hundreds of thousands of unremembered founders, really, of Western, is it okay to say Western culture? Are you allowed to say that anymore? Or is that
yeah, it's one way to put it. Christian culture.
Christendom.
You could, yeah, if you want to be even more offensive, yeah.
Why is Christendom offensive?
Well, because it's Christianity. They went from Christian culture to Western culture so as not to say Christian.
Oh, I see. I see. We have to be protected
Western culture does include, in a certain real sense, the Jewish minority or the Muslim minority or these various other aspects that exist in the West as
right.
well. But it's just not cool to say Christian culture anymore. You know, that's unfortunate, but there you are.
Yeah, I don't want anything to get in the way of my being thought of as
that's
cool.
That's why John Paul II was brilliant when he gave his talk on Europe
I don't know.
Where St. James is, Compostela.
Oh, really?
I'm
going to look this one up.
About the civilization of love. And
oh, okay.
So he talks about the re-Christianization of Europe, but he does it in terms of this context of the civilization of love.
So that people won't get spooked by the word Christian.
Christian, right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay. So England then by this, from this man, Augustine of Canterbury, then this evangelization of England, which I would characterized as a monastic evangelization of England is begun by him. So it's fair enough. I mean, some people do call him the father of English Catholicism.
But it was monastic under the governance of diocesan bishops, not just under abbots. Because the Celtic Church basically had abbots and the bishops were just kind of like liturgical functionaries.
Oh, I see.
And so the Roman order was the diocesan set up. And so that's what they established very firmly is church order such as it was found on the continent. And that was difficult to accomplish because the Celtic bishops who were there, the Britons and so on, they were very suspicious of this, you know, new power showing up, even though they knew it wasn't. I mean, they knew it was the See of Rome and all that. But Rome miscalculated in thinking that they would be more easily accepting of what was presented. And they had many, many... Gregory sent back the first group came in 595, and then later a new group was sent in 601, and he sent back to the Pope questions about what's to be done about the practice of the catechumenate, and baptism, and marriage issues, and questions of the liturgy. It was, of course, Gregory, or rather Augustine, who brought the Roman canon and the Roman liturgy to England. And it's,
you know, do we have these letters? Like we have?
We have letters. His
isn't
letters
that
to
wild?
Gregory. Yeah, because Gregory wrote his responses to all his questions.
Yeah.
Which are very amusing and fascinating on all these different practical points. But actually, the Roman liturgy, such as we have it, with the Eucharistic Prayer Number 1, as they call it nowadays, with the Roman canon and the forms of the Roman liturgy, they were introduced under Augustine of Canterbury because the Benedictine monastic influence over Europe is what really established the Roman liturgy as almost universally accepted. Yeah.
So this, I mean, I guess for those of us in the modern times who get frustrated by church politics, we didn't just invent this. But this is so you have these people who had become Christian in the Roman Empire was there in England. They had stayed Christian after the departure of the Romans, or at least of the Roman. Military.
Legions, right.
Yeah. But now they are practicing a kind of foreign Christianity, and they just don't like Augustine of Canterbury.
No, because they had a different date for Easter. Yeah. They had different customs with regarding to the wearing of their hair, of their liturgical vestments, of their liturgy.
Right.
I mean, really and truly, you can see, given human nature, why they wouldn't be so happy to see this person come and say, well, no, you got to do this now.
But I mean,
they did eventually give in.
But in one history, the Celtic Christians get really mad at Augustine because when he addresses them, he remains seated when he
Right. Well, that was the bishops were looking for a sign. And so they determined that if he rose when they entered, then they would talk to him and take him seriously. But if he did not rise, then they would not. And of course, Augustine being a Roman Christian and conscious of his authority in Roman culture, the person that's presiding doesn't rise when everyone else comes in.
Right.
Rather, they rise when you come in.
Yeah.
So, but the Britain bishops took that rather badly.
Yeah.
There were a number of gaffes. I mean, in the sense that evangelization is a very difficult thing, and some of the persecution of the church in missionary contexts is due to maybe a certain cultural insensitivity. It does happen.
Yeah. Right.
You know.
Right.
And we can hardly imagine how firmly. Well, we could imagine it if you think of like a ultra British type in the British Empire or an ultra American type in the Middle East, and that they might not. They might sort of doltishly insist on certain things that the people there just don't accept at all.
Right, yeah.
And because they take it for granted. Well, the Roman order was so ingrained in these people that at that time that the idea that anyone would question it or they would have other customs that they wouldn't relinquish immediately
right.
in view of something better was a little, you know, frustrating or strange for them. So there was a cultural tension there, but it was overcome. You know,
and how long did it take for Christianity to be united in England?
Oh, let's say, well, certainly within 100 years,
mm-hmm.
yeah, little by little. But there were all kinds of skirmishes and whatnot.
So this Catholic England, because we're running low on time now, I could talk to you for hours about this myself. But what does this Catholic England that then grows up and stays Catholic England for almost 1,000 years. What does it mean to the world that we had that period of Catholic England?
Well, the Catholic England was part of a larger reality of Catholic Europe, and the real genius of Catholic England was that it and the British Isles generally was that it united certain extremes of the European Christian culture of the time, because basically the continent of Europe was evangelized largely from the British Isles, like the Germanic tribes. St. Boniface comes from Plymouth.
Right.
All of these, I'm thinking of Columban to Italy, all that. So the missionaries that came to even to Bavaria, to southern Germany, to all over, and also in Frisia and everywhere else, they came from England to evangelize the continent. So the faith that was established there firmly, they then immediately brought it back and evangelized the tribes that were not yet Christian. You know, and that was it. So there was a sort of a cycle of evangelization that occurred. A very powerful one.
Thank you so much for the hour, Father. I hear the music, so may we have your blessing before we go.
certainly. Benedictio Dei Omnipotentis, Patris et Filii et Spiritus Sancti, descendat super vos et maniat semper.
Amen. And St. Augustine of Canterbury, pray for us.
For us, yes.